Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Joining Jeff Frederick, the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, are the Director of the Museum of the Southeast American Indian, Nancy Fields, Professor of History, Dr. Jamie Martinez, and two students, Chris Hunt and Katie Sonnen, who worked with Professor Martinez to create a historical marker commemorating the Battle of Hayes Pond. Get ready for 30 Brave Minutes.
For many, reminiscences about the 1950s harken to images of nuclear families, baby boomers entering post-World War II America at a record pace, a bustling economy converting from military to industrial and consumer product manufacturing, and idealized small towns where doors need not be locked. Local schools featured saddle shoe-wearing young girls and Letterman sweater-wearing young men, and all was right and safe and sensible. For much of the South, however, many experienced a much different mid-century. In the late 1940s, both Major League Baseball and the armed forces were integrated, beginning any number of transition points placing America's cultural institutions on a pathway to reflecting the equality promised so long ago in Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. In 1954, and then again in 1955, the Supreme Court, in two separate Brown versus Board of Education decisions, struck down segregation in schools and asked the states to rectify the matter with, quote, all deliberate speed. Over the next couple of years, the nation watched the Montgomery bus boycott, the integration of Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, and the simultaneous development and engagement of many local, state, and national organizations dedicated to redeeming and fulfilling the promise of the 14th Amendment, citizenship, due process, and equal protection for all. For all the unleashing of protest movements, including students and women, people of color, American Indians, African Americans, and Hispanic farm workers, among others, not everyone else was energized by the hope of change. Plenty were energized by other hopes as well. Across the South, citizens' councils, organizations dedicated to the perpetuation of segregation and the furtherance of white supremacy, popped up and grew in number and in reach. 101 congressmen and senators from the South signed a document known as the Southern Manifesto, decrying the court's anti-segregation decisions. Quote, "This unwarranted exercise of power by the court," the text of the document reads, "contrary to the Constitution, is creating chaos and confusion in the states principally affected. It is destroying the amicable relations between the white and Negro races that have been created through 90 years of patient effort by the good people of both races." Despite the language, obviously, relations between all of the races and ethnicities in the South had been anything but amicable, and efforts to ensure equality were no longer going to be patient. While the citizens' councils and the elected politicians mostly stayed within the legal system that they had created to defend segregation, other groups, namely the Ku Klux Klan, did not. The Klan was not a new organization. It was founded immediately after the Civil War, revived in an era around the 1920s, and then surged again in the midst of the civil rights movements. In the Border Belt area of the Carolinas, James Catfish Cole, a veteran and a traveling preacher, was a key figure in Klan activity, which he directed against blacks and Indian groups. Cole denigrated Native Americans, and in particular Lumbees, with hateful language, threats, cross-burnings, and convoys of Klansmen traveling backcountry roads. He recruited and organized Klansmen with word-of-mouth mail campaigns, handbills, and with public events, including a call for a rally in Maxton at Hayes Pond to be held on January 18, 1958. What Cole and his wife and his Klan associates found at Hayes Pond was something they didn't expect and never overcame. After being routed at the Battle of Hayes Ponds by Lumbee Indians, Cole was publicly humiliated, and 12 days later, Governor Luther Hodges denounced the Klan actions as an assault on peace and good order and a slur on the name of our state. The governor thanked, quote, "the citizens of Robeson County," though he did not refer to the Lumbees by name, though anyone who read Life magazine soon knew the rest of the story. A year later, Cole was in prison. A decade later, he was dead. Our topic for today, the Battle of Hayes Pond, and the great work by UNC Pembroke faculty, staff, and students to remember and memorialize the event. Joining me today are Professor Jamie Martinez, Nancy Fields, the director of the Museum of Southeast American Indian, and two students who worked on a project to create a historical marker commemorating the Battle of Hayes Pond, Chris Hunt and Katie Sonnen. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Hello. Welcome.
Lumbee people faced a number of challenges living in a triracial community in the segregated South. Talk about the economic and political realities that Lumbees faced in 1958.
Economically, we had to follow the color lines of Jim Crow, which meant that you could not shop in certain stores, you could not eat in certain places, restaurants, you weren't allowed to navigate the streets in certain ways. And so that disadvantage also fell in terms of, to a certain degree, owning a business or thriving in certain markets. And so Lumbee people were very savvy in how, particularly in Pembroke, North Carolina, creating their own town that provided every essential need that a person would require. And there was a saying that started even in the 1900s as Pembroke became more and more native, well into the 60s, anything that you need, you can get in Pembroke. And so as Melinda Maynard Lowry writes in her book, Lumbeeans in the Jim Crow South, there were some ways in which Lumbee people created an economy of their own, and the Lumbee people were essentially, and other Native people that were around, were the clients and the shoppers for those businesses. But outside areas, it was dangerous. It was almost impossible. It was terrifying. So everything had this arc of fear surrounding shopping or being a patron of a certain business. And so, but those are the tenets of Jim Crow. I mean, those are the realities of those color lines, you know. But then you also have the other side of the agricultural economic factor of where Native people in this region were profound farmers. There was a thriving sharecropping industry, and by virtue of being a triracial community, all of the economy, white business needed Native people for tobacco and cotton and those types of things. So it was a very unique situation in terms of what this part of the South looked like and how it was a little bit different perhaps from other parts, but not insular and a complete anomaly, because you see this in Mississippi with the Choctaws, you see it in Louisiana with the Houma and other tribes like that. It's just an underrepresented, almost untold story.
I wanted to also point out that I think one of the main reasons why the Lumbee community became so thriving for that time was because it was also a way for them to preserve their culture and to educate their children with their culture. And like what's been said, it's a very large sharecropping industry around here at the time. And also, American Indians still weren't allowed in the UNC systems. So that's why we had the School of Pembroke.
In the midst of multiple realities here, in an agricultural part of the Deep South, you have a clear segregation line requiring obedience, enforced not only through the law, but through extra-legal intimidation. And Lumbees, as well as other minority groups, are dealing with that, while at the same time carving out their own agency, holding on to their own culture, making sure that they're pulling together economically, socially, tribally, culturally.
Well, and one of the things I heard from people that I think there was some discussion of, yes, everything you absolutely needed was here in Pembroke, and you could go to Indian-run businesses and be with other American Indians, but if you wanted to go to Lumberton and go to a movie theater, the movie theater had a two-way segregation system, and so American Indians had to sit in the section that African Americans also sat in. And that was disturbing to Lumbee people because so often they were dismissed as being half-black, as not being real Indians, and in the context as well of the federal government denying them full recognition to have a local economic structure that sometimes denied their Indianness was also really troubling to them.
So the prevailing segregated culture is literally pitting different people of color against each other, and African Americans and Native Americans ending up almost competing for themselves to get to second-class status and avoid third-class status in a situation where economic and political power was still predominantly held by whites. Within all of this culture that's being held onto, the role of military service has a long-standing tradition for Lumbee Indians, and I think it's really a part of the nice context of what happened at Hayes Pond. Why is the importance of military service so woven into Lumbee culture?
Go ahead. I would have to say that would take us back to Lumbee people participating in the Indian War, the War of 1812. All they know is to fight and protect what's theirs. So when they heard that KKK were coming into their land, I feel like that's all they knew was to fight and protect what's theirs here at home.
I also had the experience with a different class doing a project where they looked at some photographs by the university photographer in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and the recurring use of the American flag of various sort of Southern denominations and Indian motifs and first pan-Indian, but then very deliberately Southeastern Indian in things like the Lumbee parades, the Little Miss Lumbee contest, things like that, that really point to this emphasis on their identity being American Indian, Southern, and American, and all of those things fitting together. And so it certainly fits within a broader pattern of defending your country, defending your community, defending your state, all of those things wrapped into one that we see among, you know, being more prevalent among Southerners often throughout this country's history. And so I think that's part of Lumbee people's identity as Southerners as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I also think there's a really interesting context because less than 2 years before what happens at Hayes Pond, you know, the federal government produces the Lumbee Act, which essentially identifies Lumbees as a separate and sovereign group, yet fails to provide the kinds of benefits and status that will be there. So for all of the military service historically noted, as Chris suggested, Lumbees didn't necessarily get the same return of thanks and appreciation from the federal government.
To comment on the military aspect, I think another big factor into it is our geographical location, because we do have Fort Bragg really, really close by. And there's a link on the UNC page that has a wonderful oral history of veterans, of Lumbee veterans. And a couple of them were paratroopers out of the 82nd. So it's our home. It's their home.
So let's build on that sense of home and that sense of service and pulling together and self-defense, as Chris noted, and standing up for what's yours. Take us back on into that January night in 1958. What's happening? How does word of the Klan rally circulate among different groups of Indians in West Robeson County? You know, take our listeners right into the event of how they're rallying up and descending on this group of Klan activities.
So at the museum, we've recently been interviewing folks that participated that evening. So it's been fascinating as you mentioned in your introduction, how well James Catfish Cole advertised. He was, you know, the Klan was extremely organized, and they marketed very well, and so they passed out those flyers, and he was on the radio, and I've also heard that there was a car that went up and down the main streets of Pembroke with a loudspeaker announcing when the rally would be happening, and so I'm sure he was trying to recruit white participants to come to the rally, and it was also a warning, right? It was a scare tactic in doing these types of things. There was a sensational event or series of events that had happened just across the line in South Carolina that had also served as a warning, and so it was saying, okay, we're going to hold a rally. Just know the Klan is present in the community. We are garnering support through white participants, but, you know, be on the lookout because fire and fury is coming. And, of course, that was not remiss on Lumbee people. And so our response was to go out and secure every bullet and shell that was available in Robeson County, and everybody armed up and was, from what I understand, organized, but organized in a way of word of mouth. Word on the street was, mm-hmm. let's come to this rally. We're going to stop this rally from happening. They can't, you know, and the fear was that their house would be burned. Ms. Bertie Locklear told a wonderful story about what was happening in South Carolina where people's houses were being burned. And she and her husband had recently acquired their home, and they said, our house is not going to be burned. They're not going to take our house. They're not going to take our family's homes. They're not going to destroy our way of life. And everyone that we've talked to has said they went into that, they went to Hayes Pond knowing they could lose their life. They were willing to fight for what was theirs, and they understood the risk that was there. But there was just so much energy surrounding going down there, and, of course, to Hayes Pond. That energy, by the time they all were there, was just at a height. And so I think when Catfish Cole took the stage, and before he even got to utter a word, someone shot out the light, and just a very visceral fight happened. And it was shock and awe because the Klan was not expecting a response in that way. So and I'll let other folks jump in, but that was kind of the energy that built up to it.
Some other aspects that happened a couple weeks prior to or days prior to the event, crosses were burned on in front of American Indian houses of women who were dating white men. And one of Catfish Cole's biggest reasons for this was race mixing and how he was so against race mixing and how it's going to destroy the South. And when he got caught by surprise by the thousands of American Indians that showed up, and Lumbee Indians and surrounding Indians, he abandoned his wife, left her, and took off trying to save his own bottom.
Well, and I think, you know, seemed to be particularly animated by a particular couple in St. Paul's that sort of drove the fury to get this raid and rally going. And that sort of continued to build on top of each other. The context of the late 1950s is those mores and cultural things are beginning to change. And those people who are really opposed to the change are thinking the traditional ways of preventing that will work. And that sort of puts him into kind of his thought process. But I'm really interested by the local response that, you know, my house will not be taken from me, and my land and my culture may not be taken from me. I may not be able to change all of the other forces and factors that are here, but on these matters, we will organize and we will work.
That's something we heard over and over again from people, is they weren't making a big political statement. They were just standing up for themselves and their families, and were kind of surprised afterwards that everyone took notice around the country, that it became a thing, and it became the Battle of Hayes Pond and the night the Klan died in North Carolina, and that was not necessarily their intent, right? That after-the-fact media interest surprised a lot of people.
That was generational. I mean, this was one episode in many, many, many episodes of racial tension, even going back to the 1800s. So you look at the Lowry Wars, you look at the disenfranchisement of people of color in the 1830s. So this was ingrained in us. You stand up and fight for what's yours. You stand up and fight for your life and your people. And it's what you have to do, because what do you have to lose if you don't?
And I was also going to add there, Nancy, like you said, that takes us back to just standing up for what we're what we stand for. And I think the Klan wasn't expecting the Lumbees or the Native Americans that were there that night to fight back. And it kind of surprised them.
Yeah, I think the organization and the collective unity among the Lumbees who descended that night on Hayes Pond was vastly superior to the level of organization and unity among the Klansmen. We sometimes carry on the sense that the Klan is marching in lockstep and they all know what they're doing, and it's all the superiority of the organizational effort of the Lumbees, you know, really caused the reaction that Katie mentioned in terms of people just saying, we got to get out of here. What in the world is going on? It's also true that in the middle of the country in 1958, when you turn out the one light bulb that's there and not all the headlights of the vehicles are going, it's dark. And you know, the level of uncertainty about what's happening, who all's out there, is it hundreds, is it thousands, who all is here. It sort of revealed the fact that many of the Klansmen, you know, had this sense of what they believed in, but when push came to shove, they weren't necessarily going to stay there to defend what they purportedly believed in, certainly not in the same way that the Lumbees were there to defend, you know, to the last ounce what they believed in. So we know the reaction here. The Klan is routed. They're driven out. We know soon Cole will be investigated. We also know there are other incidences around Southeast North Carolina that didn't go as well as he planned. The larger story here is that self-defense is an absolutely critical part of the civil rights story, and we have a really good example of it. But focusing on the Lumbees here, the next 50 years are not—they're not all magical. There are plenty of hard challenges and difficulties. How do local folk internalize the great success of standing up for themselves at Hayes Pond to help them get through some of the rough times that come in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond?
One example of a person who speaks to that is Lacey Maynor. And not a lot of folks talk about Lacey Maynor and his role in bringing justice, if you will, to the aftermath or to Catfish Coal. And so Lacey Maynor was a barber. He was a very active community member. He was actually part of the group that went up and rallied for federal recognition just a couple of years prior. And like most Lumbee people, had a huge sense of purpose and justice and all of those things. And so he was also the magistrate in Pembroke. And by virtue of being the magistrate, he was a judge that tried Catfish Coal for acts of domestic terrorism. So I like to talk about not only did they get a swift kick of justice at Hayes Pond, but there was a second round that came from a native judge who sentenced him, I think it was to a year or two in the state jail, but he didn't have enough, weight in the court system, so it was suspended or dismissed a sentence. But he had to sit in a courtroom and sit in front of an Indian judge who tried him on acts of domestic terrorism against Indian people in 1958. That is tremendous. And it's those types of actions that Native people created these unique roles, finding these unique loopholes to bring justice and equality and opportunity. UNCP is a perfect example of that to those subsequent 50 years moving forward. And it's that kind of savvy, I think, attitude or can-do attitude towards living in life, I think, in this continuation, this journey that we're on, that really has given us the tools and the skills to address situations as they arise.
I think this goes to the ongoing story of, you know, how different groups, particularly in this part of the state, Lumbee Indians, worked outside of the system to protect their rights and their culture and their preferences, but also worked within the system where it could be. So there's, you mentioned the word savvy. I mean, there's this really interesting story, this strategic and operational story of different groups, how they're protecting their interests from both inside and outside of the system.
One thing I would like to say is Lumbee people are very prideful people, and as they should be, they fought very hard to be where they are today. And as I stated earlier, like, the UNC system didn't used to let American Indians into any of their schools, and that's why we had School of Pembroke. And now Pembroke is one of the UNC schools, so it's just this, like, matter of, like, well, you're going to put me down, but I'm going to come right back up.
We'll return to our program in just a moment. UNCP and the College of Arts and Sciences are changing lives through education. To learn more about our 16 departments, college highlights, and news, explore our website. You can also support our department programs by clicking on the donate button. Additional news and events may be found by following us on Facebook at UNCP College of Arts and Sciences. And now you can subscribe to 30 Brave Minutes on Podbean and iTunes. Remember, wherever you hope to go, whatever you plan to do, you can get there from here.
Jamie, when did you get the idea to work toward a historical marker? What were the steps? How did you weave that into some of the classes you're working on?
Well, it came from a couple of different places. One is the very first time I did an introduction to public history class here at UNCP, I gave students as a final exam project the assignment that they should either propose a new marker or monument or propose revisions to an existing marker or monument. And they could pick something that they felt was an underrepresented event or an underrepresented population. And we actually brought in a number of different faculty, including you, Jeff, and some other members of the community, including Alicia, who works at the museum, to evaluate. And I kind of gave them an imaginary budget and said, tell me who in this group you think deserves funding for their project, and I will take that into consideration when I'm grading them. So one of the students did, in fact, propose the state historic marker for the Battle of Hayes Pond. And the question that came up in response to his proposal was, does this meet the criteria for a state historic marker? Because the primary criteria is it has the event or person or place being commemorated has to have significance to the entire state of North Carolina and not just one region or community. And we realized that was going to be the challenge, in part because of how the local community had always framed what had happened here as being this moment of great importance to us, but it was really about us standing up for ourselves and not about a bigger project anywhere. And so on some level, it was easier for me as a professional historian, but an outsider, and for a group of students, some of whom were Lumbee, some of whom were not, to take the big picture view and say, how do we connect this into strains of other events and other movements going on in the state of North Carolina, as opposed to having it be something that was so ingrained in us as being part of our community that we couldn't look at it from an outside perspective. So that the idea was already percolating in my head a little bit, and then when I was invited to actually serve on the State Historic Marker Board, which is a group of 10 historians from around the state, and if you're a faculty member at a university in North Carolina and your work intersects with North Carolina in any way, you're probably going to be asked to be on it at some point. When I was asked to be on the board, the administrator who runs the program, Ainsley Wagner, said, I've been questioning and sort of putting out feelers for a while to see if someone will do the proposal for a Hayes Pond marker. I think because you know how historians think, you'll be able to put together a good proposal. And I thought, but I don't want it to just be me. It would be much more interesting if we can turn it into a class project. And so that's what we did.
And what did you guys do once the work started in terms of working towards this goal? How did you and your peers attack this?
The class was separated between graduate students and undergrad students. I was on the graduate portion. Chris was on our undergrad portion. We had different tasks throughout the entire semester, gathering, you know, primary sources, secondary sources, doing the research, going out to Hayes Pond, looking at the area, figuring out where do we want to put this sign, how do we want to word it, and specific numbering for how many letters. And it's just, it was very overwhelming at first, especially when we were getting into the idea of public history and oral history and learning these new types of ways of researching history. Oral history, for me, probably was the hardest thing to really address in the situation because you have memories that you're working off of and public participation, which can sometimes be very hard for us because we had a night at the museum where we invited the public to come in and come talk to us and look at our proposal. And we had a little bit of participation, but not as much as we wanted. So you really get to see how hard it is to get your community involved, even though it is something that's, you know, talked about. Word of mouth is spread on to generation and generation. So, I mean, it was definitely a new perspective as becoming a historian.
What were you seeing, Chris?
So, as Katie added, it was very overwhelming at first. I was like, public. I was like, I don't want to talk to people. I'm from the community. I knew a little bit about what actually happened there. I actually had an uncle who was there that night. So I talked to him, was trying to get information. I wanted to go in, and everyone in the class was going to be like, well, you're from here. You should know what's going on. But we also stepped outside of, after we started gathering information, it wasn't just about, or I felt like it wasn't just about what happened here. We actually had to go back to the civil rights movement of what happened in other places. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of my assignments was to read what happened at the Chapel Hill campus. Mm-hmm. Then we also read about what happened at the Greensboro mm-hmm. campus. So it wasn't just about the Lumbee, trying to find the state's significance. So we had to go outside of the community and other parts of the state to really find out what was going on.
Jamie, how did you get them to agree on such on a sentence or two in such a limited amount of space?
It was a challenge, and we spent a lot of time working as a group. And honestly, it was one of the most fun classes I've ever taught because so much of the time I didn't have to do anything. I would just give them a set of questions, and everyone, you know, they'd sometimes it was grad students working on it and undergraduate students. Sometimes I mixed up the group. Sometimes it was one-to-one, and then they'd have to take their argument based on what they saw in the material and hear what everyone else had to say and then put them all together. And we did this 3 or 4 times over the course of the semester to try to get down to what is the key point we want to put forward on the sign, right? Which the signs are so brief, they really are just a very quick description. And we came up with what we wanted, and then as the process evolved, we also at the time, we put in the proposal, but then as the proposal was being approved and the marker was being prepared, we got more input from the Lumbee tribe that we had was sort of delayed a little bit on that process. But we got their input, and that shifted what the wording was, and that shifted the final some of the final decisions. And it was great that we were able to bring everyone together and come up with an answer that everyone was happy with. In addition to what's on the sign, we had to write kind of 4 or 5 paragraph essay that would go on the website. And that also, they had to take a semester's worth of work and boil it down to 4 or 5 paragraphs, which is hugely difficult. But that's a key part of public history. As someone's walking through a museum or looking at an exhibit or looking at a website, a lot of people are going to read the first sentence and move on. Right? If you're lucky, they might read a whole paragraph. So you somehow have to take the 30 books you've read and boil it down to one paragraph, and that's not an easy task. But I was really impressed with how well this group of students did that, and that they were good at listening to all of the voices in the room. There were some people who were much more forceful and much more committed to their position, but those people also took the time to listen to what other people have to say, and that ultimately created a project that was really the product of consensus.
Well, and masterful work by you, because all historians at whatever level, we tend to be, breaking news, a little wordy anyway, and wanting all the details and all the context in there. So what does the final statement on the sign say?
The final wording on the sign, the title is The Battle of Hayes Pond, and they had to put that in quotation marks because military historians would say this doesn't actually qualify as a battle, but it is what it is locally known as. Right? So The Battle of Hayes Pond. And the text says, "The Lumbee and other American Indians ousted the Ku Klux Klan from Maxton, January 18th, 1958, at Raleigh 1/2 mile west." So it is very much a description of what happened, and then if you want the context, you have to go to the website. But that's the case with every North Carolina state historic highway marker. They are all very brief. They're designed to be read while driving.
And, you know, the sign includes some of interesting context in the sense that Indian tribes could be divided against each other on one or more issues. And so it's really an interesting phenomenon that there is this unity of purpose. How do you all hope that this marker and this additional text on the website will be used by groups, local, non-local, Indian, non-Indian? How do you hope people will take advantage of what you've built here?
Being a first-year 7th-grade history teacher, I definitely would like to see it being taught in our school, in our classrooms, not just inside of Robeson County, but outside of Robeson County as well, because it teaches our children, you know, this is actually what happened in North Carolina in the home that you live in, and it shows a sense of pride, and it should show equality and will teach equality at least.
And I know they would want me to mention this, and Katie, it's something you might not be aware of, but on the one of the things the North Carolina Historical Highway Marker Program does, if you go to their website, is they have some activities that you can do with students at different levels in your classrooms. And if you're in a different state, you can certainly apply it to the markers that exist in your state too.
And also to add to that you could also tie that into, again, the civil rights movement. You know, this happened here, just like they teach what happened in Chapel Hill, Greensboro, different parts of the not just our state, in different states. So this could also be taught, well, hey, let's look, let's see what happened in North Carolina. Could be
and
added.
It teaches I wanted to teach our kids that, you know, segregation in civil rights wasn't just a binary separation of people. There was other minorities and other cultures that were also being affected by the civil rights movement and Jim Crow.
Well, the marker is a wonderful addition to all the good work done by the museum and by the tribe, by our students, by our historians, to sort of make sure that this history and the force of it, as well as the memory, sort of continues to echo down generations. Well, thank you all for a fascinating discussion on the Battle of Hayes Pond. We also thank our listeners and hope you'll tune in next time for another edition of 30 Brave Minutes.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves.
Good job, everybody.